Hello, everybody. Welcome to a French Village podcast. I'm Sarah Longwell, and I'm here with my brilliant friend, Ben Wittes. Hey, Ben, how you doing?
Hey, guess where I am?
Looks somewhere pretty.
I am at my secret farm, just like Marie, where I can hide and, you know, the American Gestapo can't find me, and I've got my whole resistance network here. So the next time the FBI tries to, you know, use a false flag operation to spark a rebellion against the authorities, I am going to run my resistance operation from my cabin in the woods, just like Marie.
Is that where the baby cannon lives?
The baby cannon does live here, yes. Although the baby cannon has been vacationing in Washington, but all the baby cannon videos are made right there on that corner of my cabin fence.
Yeah, that looked familiar to me, that railing. I've seen it before. So Ben, love is in the air in Villeneuve.
We've got a serious hookup culture going on in Villeneuve.
You know, I made a list of, in our two episodes, all of the people and relationships that we are now sort of back in business and new relationships, right? So here's my list. There is Danielle and Sarah, Berrio and Lucien. Schwartz appears to be hanging out with the maid that she now works at the sawmill, the maid from his house, the one that got her nose broken with the butt of the rifle when she was working for Janine, who was fired. So she's hanging out. He appears to be sleeping at the office. Janine is hooking up with that guy, that horrible guy.
Yeah, the Chassin. Lawyer. I can't remember his name.
How do you think you pronounce his name?
I can't even remember how it's spelled.
It's like C-H-A-S-S-A-N-G-E.
Oh, Chassagne.
Chassagne?
Chassagne.
Okay, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
And then Mueller is back.
Yeah, Heinrich Mueller.
Back after Hortense.
Although Hortense is not having any of it. She tears up his note and pours champagne on his flowers. Hortense, you know, she's reached her limit. You know, it's okay if you want to arrest her maid or, you know, or kill people. But if you torture Hortense herself, that's the line. She's not dating you after that, at least not yet.
Well, I want to talk about this because this is sort of like the season three redemption of Hortense we've been getting.
She seems to have developed an art exhibit that is all pictures of her.
I want to talk about that. It's amazing. It's perfect. We will talk about it. But then there's also Marie and our new guy, Vincent.
Yeah, love's in the air with them.
Radio operator.
And Suzanne is back.
Oh my gosh, let me do my list.
Okay, sorry.
Yes, there's Marcel and Suzanne. Suzanne comes back at the end of the second episode. Marcel shows up again, and they are reunited in a vicious scene towards the end of the second episode that we watched. There is Raoul and the store girl who for a kiss has traded a piece of contraband in the form of a tube for a radio. And then there is Rita and Marchetti, and Rita is pregnant, a thing I find more or less implausible generally, but okay. And so that is a lot of relationships that we have to navigate that are in these two episodes.
Yes, there's a bunch of romantic slash marriages slash lusts slash crushes going on. And I find this completely believable because I think if the Nazis invaded my little village and you feel like you have no control over anything. The first thing everybody would do is kind of YOLO the romantic stuff. and so I think it's totally believable.
I agree. And also, I sort of, with the exception of the relationships that I have commented on before, this is a good universe. They're really putting the French in French Village right now. And I think we should title this one Love and Radios, because these are the two things that are really driving the plot forward. There is a lot of, not only is a radio a central plot point, but there's a lot of people listening to the radio, which brings me to so I as much as we will talk about the romances and how they're driving the narrative forward, but the big external thing driving sort of a new shift in energy in the village is the fact that the Americans have landed in Algiers, North Africa. And I am excited for you to tell me about the history of this.
Okay, so my military history of the Western Front in World War II is not great, but here is what I remember. and audience members who know this history better than I do, feel free to tweet at me and correct me if I get anything wrong. So we are now late in 42 because this is 4 months after the July roundups of Jews. So we're now in November of 42, which was the time of Operation Torch, which was in early sort of the first half of November 42. And it was an Allied invasion of French North Africa, I believe, led by General Patton.
Eisenhower. Eisenhower.
Was it Eisenhower?
Yes. I Wikipedia'd this last night.
Okay.
One reason I know that.
So this was a delicate thing for a couple of reasons. The first was that Vichy France was formally neutral in World War II, but was allowing German transport across North Africa, and so the invasion was effectively Germany had France had been invaded by Germany, and now what we don't think of as France, but they thought of as an integral part of France, which is French North Africa, is invaded by the Allies. This was really important to the Allies because it was potentially a gateway to Sicily, which was a gateway in turn to Italy, which was, the European front. And of course, the Sicily invasion does in fact happen relatively shortly after the North African invasion, and contrary to common belief, is the first Allied landing in Europe. It is not Normandy, but before that, there is Sicily, but from the French perspective, this was a big deal because it was a kind of threat to the idea, the Germans had invaded and were occupying northern France or France, much of France proper. And now the Allies were invading and were occupying what they thought of as southern France or the home, some of the non-home territories, but the closest colonies. And so from their perspective, this was, a very, very scary thing. But as you see in the episode, a lot of French people are kind of excited about it. So the more Republican people, like
Berrio
is openly excited about it and is talking to the baby about it. His wife, who's, you know, kind of got a foot in all worlds and is also stupid, doesn't really know what to make of it, but isn't like, this is terrible, right? Larchet is secretly happy about it. Servier, being servile, is not. So, you know, you're starting to see the political divisions that we've all seen socially really start to map on to military actions.
Yeah. And I got to tell you, I was like, when people say things, this is just, I'm just going to admit this outright. I'm not great with my geography. And so when people say things like Algiers, whatever, I'm like, I don't even know where that is. Like, where is that in relation to this village? But it was interesting to go, when I watched this the first time, I like didn't bother to be like, oh, let's go read about this. But I did go read about Operation Torch last night. And it was one of the things that was interesting is that it was a three-pronged attack. So, but it was on Casablanca. So it was, that was the sort of, I mean, we know some about that sort of through popular culture. The Casablanca, where they had a major base. And then Oran, is that how you pronounce that? Was at the center. And then Algiers is eastern. And then they went into Tunis. And that is where the Allied forces began their moves in World War II. And what I love about the episode, like that you talk about Berio talking to the baby, but when he talks to Lucienne, he's talking about how he's pro-American. And this is sort of the first time we start to, one of the things that is interesting about the show is, this isn't really a spoiler, but you do get a little bit more of this like perception of the Americans and the Allies as this goes on. And I found that very interesting in the show. Also, I just think that little bit of tension that it adds to whether it's Mueller, whether it's Servier, but the idea that this thing is a live issue, you know, when people say the right side of history, what they mean is, right, is that at some point perceptions of this are going to be different 10, 20 years from now. Were you on the right side of history? And you can feel it. I think the show does a good job of giving Servier and even Mueller a little bit of this sense of like, boy, this, it is possible this doesn't go our way. Like they never, and nobody says it outright. Like they're all intensely interested in hearing the news and what's going on the radio, but it's, and actually maybe there is a part where a couple of them say like, this could be bad for us, but it's not, they're not saying, they're not like having extended conversations about it. It's just in the air that the Americans having moved in is a potential game changer, and there for the first time you feel it on them, that sense that maybe they're not on the right side of history.
Yeah, and so there's a couple of references to this. Mueller, as you note, for the first time sort of says, we can't win the war with idiots like this, right? It's the first time like the Germans are really kind of rocked back on their heels. It's the point on the Western Front, at least, where they are being knocked back a little bit. And it's kind of the first time, other than, I suppose, the Battle of Britain. But, you know, this is the moment where the tides of the war are just starting to change a little bit. Of course, we're still before Stalingrad, but we're, you know, but the, and this wasn't an Axis territory, of course. It was a supposedly neutral territory. But, you know, the front is advancing for the first, or from the German point of view, receding for the first time. The second thing that is referred to in the article, in the episodes, and this, my memory may be off on this, is there's the references to the French commander in North Africa, Darlan. And Darlan, the significance of this is that I believe this was the time at which he switched sides. And so he was the commander of North Africa, of French North African forces, and he was a Vichy official. And there's a fairly substantial French army in North Africa. And he ordered that army to cooperate with the Allies, which is effectively, not resisting the Allied sweep in. And this was perceived as, treasonous by Vichy. He is, I believe he was relatively soon thereafter assassinated. But it meant that the Allies essentially occupy North Africa without a, without having to have a war with France. There is, of course, relatively soon, major combat in North Africa, the famous, North African campaigns. But from a French, if you're living in a village in France, the big thing that just happened was the Vichy government lost control over its own army in North Africa. And that is a very, very big deal.
Yeah. So then getting into the way that this sort of impacts the episode, besides you see it in the sort of external dialogue among the officials and in Berio, but then also the central action is that Daniel and Sarah they're post-coital and they decide they want some fresh milk, which they go to a cow, some farmer they clearly go get milk from.
Which, by the way, is a weird scene. Like, you're post-coital, and he says, you know what I really want? And you think it's going to be something romantic or sexual. And he says, and she says, to be young again, which is kind of what you're expecting her to say. And then he says, no, to go get milk, fresh milk for the baby and for Gustave. And I just thought, that's a weird ass thing to say. And then there's no explanation of it. The next shot is them getting milk from a cow.
Yeah, I mean, these are just like, sometimes when they do these things and you're like, oh, you needed to get them into the barn to start having this thing. And like, that was your way to do it. Okay. But so while they're in there, blood's dripping from the ceiling, Daniel goes up, they find a guy there who's been shot. And it's reminiscent actually of the time the dude parachuted in and they've got to, figure out who he is and what to do with him. Although this guy does speak French. And so they're able to sort of quickly ascertain that he is, somebody who, is worth helping, isn't a danger to them. And Daniel goes to get help. Sarah stays there. And this is the beginning of the sort of radio situation, which I guess I think is probably just worth the whole of the plot is these guys. It sounds like there's three of them came in through the airfield, parachuted in. They got one of them got killed right away. One of them is shot and injured, and then one of them gets away. And the guy who was shot and injured is in the barn when Sarah and Daniel are trying to help him. The guy that got away winds up at Marie's looking for the head of the local resistance with whom he is supposed to connect so that he could, so that he can fulfill his mission. And it actually starts with Berio, where somebody shows at the door and they've got like a code that says like, what is it? Victor Hugo is something.
Was born in Besançon.
Yeah, that's right. Very cloak and dagger, but the show is sort of at its best in my opinion. Like, my favorite things are when this network of resistance people in Villeneuve, as they like sort of come together and you see them trying to operate. So Berio gets the code. He takes this guy whose name is Vincent, takes him to Marie. Marie has got Cremieux is living with her there. And so there's this little band of resistance. Sarah, you see at some point sort of in the first episode that the guy who was injured gets brought in to Marchetti's office. Like they're on a search for these guys. They know they're there. And they also seem to know about the that it's a radio operator. And they're very worried about this because this is, these operations are like how information gets communicated. And it is, it seems to be a big threat to them. I don't know if you want to talk about that before I hit the rest of the plot on it.
Well, so the French, so the, I think the interesting thing that you've alluded to here is how much better organized the this little resistance cell is than it was when we left them. It has a leadership structure. It has developed modes of communication with other cells. It has, you know, a way for a stranger to introduce himself and be recognized as a real person, although it's they don't trust it completely. And it's developed enough that the Free French are sending them a radio operator to get information, or sending a radio operator to their area and notifies them for help. So you're starting to see the development of, you know, genuine organized resistance rather than just, you know, scattershot activity. And you're seeing it later when the communists meet. I don't mean to mix plot lines, but these are actually closely related plot lines. The communists announce that to each other that the new party line is cooperation with all anti-fascist elements, irrespective of class, irrespective of, you know, anything. This is, you know, the, what they call the Popular Front or the National Front. And they are, you know, which is a, basically a green light to find the people like this and cooperate with them or work with them. And this is really how the, you know, the French Resistance of fame came to be. It was sort of a coalition of, you know, communist and nationalist elements, you know, and there's an exchange with the, in the, among the communists, do you mean even the Gaullists? And, you know, the communist apparatchiks like, yeah, even the Gaullists, we got to work with them. And, you know, this was a big deal for, and so this is kind of, you know, a fictionalized depiction of that, but that is really happening in this period of time. And it grabbed a lot of very improbable people and made heroes and sometimes a lot of dead people out of them. And you see that here too, where the radio operator is looking for some important person named Dominique, who of course turns out to be Marie, and he's incredulous that Dominique could be a woman, by which he also means let alone a lower class peasant sharecropper woman.
Yes. And it is when we learn too. I mean, we obviously know that Marie is important to the resistance, that she's been involved. What we don't know is that she has somehow set herself up as kind of an anonymous, she's the boss of the of a part of the resistance there. She's the main contact. And he even says, like, you're not allowed to be a woman. But they have clearly all decided that she should be the leader and she should just pretend to be a man so that everyone will communicate with her, but that she's the one that they're following.
Yeah, and it's not clear. I mean, it clearly happens in the four-month lag. It's not clear how it happened, although the it would have surely enhanced her prestige that she personally slips into the school makeshift concentration camp and fakes a case of meningitis with a kid and gets her out, albeit almost only temporarily. So, I mean, I think you can sort of see how her combination of cautious but also can-do attitude in the episodes that we've seen kind of leads to a lot of respect for her. She's the one who delivers information from Schwartz. And so, you know, we've actually seen her get a lot done. And she's also the least in hiding of the group, with the except, you know, Berio has been exposed and arrested. And so Cremieux is in hiding. De Caverne is missing. I assume he's going to come back at some point. But Marie is, you know, operating relatively freely, although she had been arrested at one point. And so I think there's it's not totally surprising that she's a come into her own.
Yes, I think that's right. And I sort of there's a later in the episode, actually towards the end, you know, there's this sort of storyline where Raoul is back, right? So her son now, who has been around, we've seen him as like a petulant teenager, now is, you know, on the cusp of manhood, maybe he's 16 or something.
And he's still a petulant teenager.
He's still a petulant teenager, but he's into being part of the resistance.
See, this and is what all petulant teenagers need is Nazis. Because it's like, boy, do they give you material to work with as a petulant
teenager. Aren't they just useful?
Yeah, exactly.
He's, you know, they can just jump on his bike and he's ready to go fight the powers that be.
And get a kiss out of it, too.
And he's certainly not above, flirting with a girl to get it. But there's this part that I just before we close on Marie, there's this part where, he does this whole operation, right? Where he has this girl, he knows she works in a shop, he can get a radio tube, get her to replace the new radio tube that they'll take, put the old one in the box, which of course they end up selling to the cops. In an unfortunate twist for them, for the young woman, but he knows how to sort of sweet talk his way into getting what he needs out of this. And obviously, there's this concern about whether or not this is going to, you know, expose the resistance. But you know, he decently covers his tracks and everything else, or so we hope. But there's this moment where it's clear they've been able to get this tube operational. The radio guy, Vincent, is transmitting the information. And he says to Raoul, "Your father would be so proud of you." And Marie has sort of just hugged him and said that she herself is proud of him. But you see this look on Raoul's face of, you know, that occasionally a teenager gives you that glimpse of the thing that's important to their heart, right? And it's clear to that what is important is his father's sort of posthumous respect or regard. And so he takes pleasure in Vincent saying this, when of course what Raoul doesn't know is that his father was a jerk, actually like kind of the worst. His mother was a badass who shot him in an important moment where she needed to like take that blood on her hands to get them out of a while she was running one of a very early resistance mission, and that it is in fact his mother who is the one who is leading the resistance. And anyway, they do that sort of subtly, and it's a nice and interesting moment.
Yes, and it is clearly a foreshadowing of some confrontation that her son Raoul and she are going to have over who his father was and. Whether he was, what precisely were the circumstances of his untimely demise. I will say I hate the plot point about the radio tube and the hardware store because it's done clumsily. And, you know, this is a small town, but it is not so small that the likelihood that if you con the shopkeeper's daughter into giving you a new tube and replacing it with a tube from Your Broken Radio, that the next person to walk into the shop and order that particular tube is going to be the cops who happen to be looking for your particular radio, because their radio, where they were trying to listen to the marshal respond to Darlan's defection, happens to have broken at the same time. And I thought, you know, it would have been a better move, I think, if Elian, the girl who sold the radio tube, had just betrayed him because, you know, he didn't give her a kiss or something. Like, this was just in the land of, okay, it's a small town, but it's not like there are six people who live in it and they all have broken radios.
So I do have to tell you, this is an extremely important point and something that I think about a lot, which is the show alternately either makes the town so big that, like, Marie is able to just in like a costume of a nurse go into the school and like not have everybody be like, hey, that's Marie from the farm. So the town is either so big that, you know, these people can move without everybody knowing who they are. And then alternately, yes, so small that Daniel, you know, pops over to this farm we've never seen for the fresh milk. And the cops, you know, I mean, there's like a million of these, like, oh, it's so small that these coincidences happen all the time. I agree with that. My feeling is that you're right, that that's a sloppy plot point, and that it really is a bigish town. I think they go more in the big town and then sometimes do these stupid little things.
Yeah, I think they're like the inconsistencies about the size of the town is peculiar, because there really are people in the town who don't know each other. And then there are people in the town who know absolutely everybody. And, you know, everybody has a radio and they all use the same tube and the cops are breaking their radio at the same. I mean, you know, like, if you broke your radio, the likelihood that you would replace your radio tube at the same hardware store with the same tube that just happens to, I mean, it's a little bit clumsy.
Don't you think there's probably only like one tube though? I mean, I don't really know much about tubes, but what we learn about them in the episode is that prior to the war, they didn't put serial numbers on them, but now since the war, they do put serial numbers on them. And the reason that the cops know the girl's lying about having replaced it is because they've got a non-serial number tube in the thing. And like, they actually even talked to the supplier. Like, they'd gotten a lot of information about the tubes pretty quickly. So I guess I did think that perhaps, because I was doing the same thing in my head, is like, how plausible is all this? And so my part of what I was giving them as the benefit of the doubt was the idea that like, there's only one kind of radio tube.
I would assume that if he was coming from London and with information from the RAF about a bombing raid on this German airbase, he would be using a British radio, actually. So I don't know. I mean, I just thought it was a little bit too neat that both sides' radios broke at the same time and they needed the exact same tube. And no one else's radio in all of Villeneuve broke that day, and they needed the same tube and bought the broken tube in between. It just seemed a little too perfect.
Speaking of things that are implausible, how plausible do we think the fact that Rita is pregnant with Marchetti's child?
At 40, relatively quickly.
I mean, they say 40 on the show to give you some whatever. I'm not going to go into Rita's age again, but I find this idea that Rita is pregnant slightly implausible. But I don't know, my mom had my sister when she was 41. I'm not saying it's too, that's, but their just whole relationship to me has always,
Yeah, their relationship doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, it makes sense from his point of view, but I'm not sure why it makes sense from her point of view. She doesn't seem to be wising up to the fact that he's separated her from her mother by getting her mother arrested. I can't figure her out as a character at all. What do you think?
I mean, I just, this idea, so I actually don't see it from either perspective. I find it incredibly odd. So I hate this relationship the whole way through, like from start to finish. I find it, I think he is like a 31-year-old guy. And she is 41 and now he's impregnated her. Him who is arresting Jews, who has no interest in Jews, who has sent her mother away, deciding that he's in love with this Jewish woman. To me, it doesn't feel earned. And I've never quite understood. And then on her end, this is the kind of guy who's going to like run this major risk, of having a Jewish lover, when he's not a good guy, you know, like what, he's going to do it all for love. I just sort of don't buy that about Marchetti. And then on her end, this guy is like rounding up Jews. Like, yes, he protected her, but the idea that she, it would not be implausible to me were she using him to survive in some way or whatever, but like, that is not how it plays on the show. The way they play it on the show is she is in love with him too. And I just am like, what? This is a bad guy and you've seen him be a bad guy. So like, and now you guys are having a kid together and you're going to get married. Also like this idea, right? So she is, he like proposes to her and oh, she's very excited about this idea. They're going to get married. On what planet does that work in this particular timeline? Like could French cops who are rounding up Jews just go ahead and marry Jewish women?
So he gave her false papers. And so I think she, as long as everybody who knows keeps their mouth shut, she moves around relatively freely and does not count as a Jew. Even
but they
though,
also, like, lots of people know. Like, it's like Servier,
well, Servier knows,
but acts like he doesn't.
And the other
Laureate.
Cops know. But, you know, people, individuals know, but, you know, Servier is not interested in keeping her secret, but he is interested in, you know, keeping Marchetti loyal and reasonably happy. And so Servier pretends not to know. I don't know how realistic that is, how many people were able to kind of hide in plain sight because they had fake papers.
Okay, well, I'm going to rank my relation, how much I like the relationships on the show. And I'm going to tell you that I like Marchetti and Rita the absolute least.
Worse
followed
than,
shortly by Daniel. Followed
wait a
shortly
minute.
By Daniel
wait
and Sarah. Wait, no. You're right. Hortense and Muller. I should have written this down.
Hortense and
Hortense
Muller's
and the worst.
Because there's
They're
actual
not technically
torture
together
in
at
the
this
relationship.
Moment. There's not, no, yeah, I think the bad.
Like, I think once we've like gouged, what was it? Gouged.
Hortense's arm, like
arm
with the,
out,
with the
off. Yeah, the yeah. Yeah,
pincers
the clipper with the pincer. You know, like that's a new level of yuck.
Right. That's
arm
like
gouging.
Not like safe word. They're not like having a safe word. Like
right.
He's,
no.
He's
so
a,
for
he's
people
a
in the audience who are thinking yeah. of doing that with your partner, no.
Yeah. Right. So, okay, you're right. So, fine. So, Hortense, Muller, Marchetti, and Rita, and then Daniel and Sarah.
Ugh, I'm so not with you on Daniel and Sarah. I like Daniel.
I
and
know
Sarah.
You're not. Yeah. I will tell you that the Chassonnier.
Yeah, they're
and,
worse.
And Janine. No, but they're worse people, but they make sense together. Like, as my sense of, like, who, like, that, I buy that relationship, that those two toxic, you know, horrible people have found each other and are, like, scheming together, totally works for me as a story, like,
well,
as a relationship
that,
and a
you say that
line.
About Hortense and Muller, too.
Although, I think that's true. I am more interested in the Muller-Hortense relationship than I am in the Rita like, I find that plausible and interesting and a thing that we know happened. I find the Marchetti-Rita pairing, like, just not plausible
super creepy
on either side. Yeah. Do you want to talk about, there's an interesting sort of side story, which they never show us, or at least have not to date shown us the airfield, but we have heard reference to this airfield many times, and it has something to do with the concrete factory, because it's supplying concrete to the airfield. So it has like a business, there's a business element, but it's also what the resistance has been trying to get their hands on in terms of information, because I think it has to do with like who's coming in and out of the airfield is very important information. It's also what the Germans are very keen to protect. At some point, somebody makes reference to this, the idea that the Krauts are crazy about the airfield. And so there's this side plot where Chassagnier and Jeanine go to Schwartz, who again, now living with the maid. That is a relationship I am that would rank in the middle-ish for me, middle to good. she's like an age appropriate, normie. But they go and offer him an extraordinary amount of money. I don't know how much 500,000 francs is. And then they up it to 600,000 for the concrete factory. They want to buy him out. But it's unclear why. Do you know why? Or is it just unclear?
I'm not sure we're supposed to understand it yet. There is clearly a... there's clearly a reason that they want full control over the concrete factory. It clearly relates somehow to this airfield. He does not want to give it up for purely reasons of petulance and that he hates his wife. But it is not clear to me what that reason is. We do know it has something to do with the intelligence operations that the Allies are running, or at least there's some connection. They want, everybody's coming to be interested in this airfield, and the concrete factory is engaged with it somehow, but it is not clear to me what is motivating the two of them, other than they want to get Schwartz out of the way.
So my theory, based on something Chassagnier says, he says, I'm going to be the most powerful man in Villeneuve. He says that like while they're having, bad people sex. So the power, I think, is the fact that this airfield is clearly very important to the Germans would make him then very important to the Germans if he owned it. And so I think they want Schwartz out of the way. And I think that while Schwartz is definitely not selling to them out of petulance, I also think he is both aware with that sum of money that they want it very badly and that probably they want it for bad purposes. And so he doesn't give it up for that reason. And also he knows that it's important to Marie still on some level in the resistance. And so I just thought that was like an interesting way to tell part of the story.
Yeah, the resistance is interested in the airfield because the Germans are protecting the airfield. The Germans are interested in the airfield because it's an airfield, right? And they're presumably using it for military purposes. Remember, this is still the period in which the British and the Germans are fighting for air supremacy. And so, we don't really know what they're using this this airfield for, but we're not yet at the part of the war where the Allies have, kind of uncontested supremacy of the air. There's a battle within the family for control of the concrete factory, which is important because of the airfield. But we don't really know what Chassagnier and Jeanine Schwartz are plotting with respect to the concrete factory.
Yes. Okay. Also, another incredibly interesting thing that happens in these two episodes. So one of the, I mean, the best thing about these two episodes, I really enjoyed them, is like everyone's back, right? Like we haven't seen Marcel in a really long time. He's back. The whole communist crew is back. I was really excited that Suzanne shows up at the end.
Are back.
Yeah, but and Mueller is back, which from a like, obviously no one's ever happy to see an SS psychopath, except from a plot standpoint.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, plot. It's to have him back. But one of the things that's fun is that in both cases, Mueller, who remember when he was kicked out, it was by Kollwitz, who he now shows up and makes sure to tell Kollwitz he is now outranks him. Right. So when Mueller comes back, whatever he's done, in the intervening months, in Siberia has enhanced his reputation. He's been promoted. And so he comes back and immediately sort of is saying to Kollwitz, like, you can't send me anywhere now. Like, I'm the boss of you, which is fun, actually, because Marcel also does that to Paul, where in when he comes back, he says, like, whatever he's been doing off in Paris, you know, he comes back and tells Paul, you made a mistake. And by letting a political error, and you need to go do a self-assessment, and I'm in charge now. Which, of course, in that part conversation, Paul accepts in that weird way the communists talk, where they like think about their own set of rules. And he says, that is true. I accept that. But then, of course, right at the end, somehow Paul has gone and found Suzanne and brought her to the house to prove that, because one of the things that has helped bolster Marcel's reputation is this idea that he killed Suzanne and sort of took care of that political error.
Yes. So there's a funny line between Marcel and Danielle when Danielle brings Sarah to hide at their parents' house and finds Marcel there. They get into an argument, as they always do. And Marcel says, you change lines more often than the party, which reflects his, you know, sort of, he's a loyal party member and he has contempt for the party kind of all at the same time. And so that kind of presages the latest party line change, which is, okay, now remember at the beginning of the show, the party's position is this war has nothing to do with us. We don't have a problem with Germans. Then the Germans invade the Soviet Union and they're like, you know, we got to kill German officers. And now their position is we got to work with anybody. And this, you know, just reflects different orders from Moscow. But the result of this, of course, and this, you know, plays out in mostly non-murderous ways in resistance France, but it plays out in super murderous ways all through Stalinism, is that by following the party line at one time, you run afoul of the next party line and can be purged for that political error. And so, you know, Paul, who is, you know, kind of the ultimate party apparatchik, believes completely in whatever the party line is now, follows orders then, and now has to do a self-assessment for following, you know, for doing exactly what the party line was then. You know, this is many, many, many people, Pauls, lost their lives in the gulag over just such trivia. And, you know, and so it comes off as funny in this context, but it's actually, you know, one of the real you know, senseless crimes of Stalinism is that, you know, the more you believe in it, the more likely you are to take seriously an order that somebody later will decide is a political error, and then you have to denounce yourself. And so what he does is he has leverage, and the leverage is that he knows, it turns out, that his underling, who turns out to be his overling, didn't in fact carry out the murder of Suzanne. And he, in a kind of Woody Allen Marshall McLuhan moment, says, yeah, well, I have your Marshall McLuhan right here. Let's see what she thinks. And of course, Suzanne, who we haven't seen since she ran off to Switzerland, walks in and looks terrified and then turns into a postcard. And so I guess we will have to discuss what happens next week.
Yeah, great to see her, though. Great to see her.
She is one of my faves.
Yeah, so the Marcel-Suzanne relationship is ranks among my top relationships. Shortly after, they're not actually together right now, but Schwartz and Marie also are among my favorites. Okay, so let's spend some time, though.
Marie can do better than Schwartz. I don't like Schwartz. I mean, I kind of like Vincent for Marie.
Yeah.
At least for now. Until he turns out to be a creep.
I have no knowledge about the future on that, but I will say yes, he's cute. They're renegades together, and that's nice. He teaches her a little bit, you know. And this is what I like about the Marie character, just in general, is that she's just always so interested. And it's part of the way that she's, you know, she's very interested in learning how he does the coding to send, you know, the messages. And you know, that is how she becomes a person. Is she's just like learning all the time. She has that innate desire to always sort of understand how things work and learn more. But that also obviously serves to give them, you know, time to flirt and become interested in one another. But let's spend some time on Hortense and Muller, because he's back, and he immediately, besides getting Daniel and Servier in to make sure everybody knows the boss is back, he tries to send her flowers and what's funny is there's a whole bunch of preposterous things that I don't believe. Despite the fact that he tortured her, despite the way that they left things, I still believe that this is how he would behave should he come back.
Well, let's pause a minute to respect the interaction between Hortense's infinite narcissism and his crazed sadism. So she is preparing an exhibit of paintings of herself, which we so far have no explanation. For some reason, Danielle is not discouraging the use of his house for this purpose. But back into town rides the Nazi sadist, who thinks, obviously, having taken a gouging pincer to her bicep, that's nothing in front of her husband. That is nothing that some flowers and champagne will not address. He sends her flowers. She tears his note in half. So far, so good for Hortense. So then he, of course, does the second step in any kind of romance of a woman that you've tortured. You send people to kidnap her and force her into a car where you give her champagne and more flowers. Okay, she then makes a perfectly appropriate speech. Never, you know, there's no you and me, right? Blah, blah, blah. And she pours the champagne into the flowers. To which, now this is where it goes a little bit awry, and I think you can see the seeds of stuff that's going to happen in the next few episodes. She then delivers this speech and does not bolt out of the car. She seems kind of hesitant to get out of the car. And he opens the door for her, and there's this pause. Now, to all the women who have been or are soon to be courted by sadistic SS guys, when they open the door for you, get out. Don't wait on the getting out of the car part. This is your chance. Hortense, however, being infinitely self-absorbed, does pause a moment before fleeing the car because, you know, whatever else this guy may be, and he is quite literally a sadistic Nazi who has tortured her in the not too recent past, he does seem obsessed with her, and that they have in common.
A 100%. There is the part where he like grabs her face, you know, like she is.
Yeah, there. Oh, I forgot. There was face grabbing in there.
There was. And like, you know, and it looks like you're not sure what he's going to do. And he remembers there is actually somebody else in the car because he's got a driver. And so he like doesn't go so far. But you can tell that there is the magnetism of his sadism for her is there. You're right about the hesitation. She is saying all the right things. But when she gets out, Mueller says to the driver, "I just can't tell if she's sincere." And the driver sort of says back, like, "Well, maybe that's what attracts you about her. And he, of course, is like, of course it is, right? He just, this idea that there is this cat and mouse game with her, that he is sort of obsessive, that she's, it is great stuff. I love their scenes together, because they're bananas. But it makes for great television. I think you tag on something that I think I kind of, the first time I watched it, I was very much in the, okay, Hortense is getting like a big redemption arc. That goes from the freeing Sarah to now like hating Mueller and saying all the right things. But you, a more keen observer, I think, than I, pick up on the little seedlings that say perhaps this relationship is not over. But please do give me your, so it's amazing that she is, and remember, Hortense views herself as a bit of the artist. Her early flirtations with Mueller was about Mueller was about art. And so she's a student of art. And so she has her first art exhibit. The camera pans and to see the display of her art. And it is all pictures of herself, all self portraits. What do you make of that? I mean, besides the obvious.
Well, there is the obvious, you know, and look, the through line of her character, and she is one of the best written characters in the show, is that she is always thinking only of herself. When she's rescuing Sarah, it is because that would be, in her perception, good for her relationship with Danielle. When she is having an affair with the Nazi, she's always thinking of herself and only herself. And so she's now drawing. What else would she draw? She doesn't think about anything except herself. And by the way, she's a very good looking woman. And so, which she knows. And so she does a remarkably diverse set of self-portraits. And Mueller finds out about this. And I think we are heading toward a great scene at the opening of the self-portrait show, about which I am personally very excited.
It is the best. It is the best. Can you imagine if you were doing an art show? If my pal was doing an art show and I walked in and what they had done was just nothing but a series of renderings of themselves, I would be very concerned about their well-being because that is a psychotic thing to do. And the fact that Daniel just is like, okay, these look very nice. How many people are coming? And she says, boy, the whole town's coming to like look at pictures of me. Because you just think about the way a normal, like I would be so humiliated by this. It's a childish sort of way to make people pay attention to you. But it's great. But it's a great plot point.
Yes. And again, because the character is infinitely narcissistic, the show has prepared you for it in lots of... And it doesn't dwell on it in this. It's just like, it's this one panning shot where, you know, it shows all the pictures and it's all her. It's actually, I thought, very well done and kind of, at least so far anyway, not very commented upon.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about just a couple other quick plot points before we wrap here. So one thing that is really interesting in these two episodes is there a cop that we have seen as like one of the sort of police officers in Marchetti's group, Vernet, turns out to be a cop within the resistance. We see that when Marie and Vincent go to get the radio back, and it becomes clear that Vernet has managed to get the cops away so that they could come in without being caught, and that he and Marie know each other and are actively working together. It also sort of solves what is a bit of a mystery in these episodes of like who's calling people to say, hey, you got to get, you know, them out of here. Let them know this. It's clearly this guy who is kind of the inside resistance. And not only that, but Marchetti is on to him that he is part of the potentially the resistance, and that he and Lariat no longer trust him because he's doing things like internally arguing, you know, against picking up Berio and everything else. But it comes out of nowhere, but not in a way that feels cheap. It actually comes out of nowhere in a way that you're like, oh, that guy, that you've seen him.
Yeah. So the thing that highly local resistance can do that is very hard to do from outside is recruit individuals, because these are all people who interact with each other, who have relationships with each other, who have a sense of each other's politics. And there's a nice reference to this when the radio operator realizes that, you know, she's recruited a cop. He says, you know, you've recruited a cop? And she's mm-hmm. like, yeah, you know, I do what I can. And it's, you know, from London, it's very hard to recruit cops. But in a small town, you know, and remember that Loriot, who is, as best as we can tell, a loyal national policeman, other than having a thing for Suzanne and, you know, looking the other way so she can get away. Now that she's back, it's not just Vernet who's potentially recruitable. This guy has aided a communist escape, and presumably the communists who, including Marcel, who are aware of this, you know, are aware that he's compromised and he's potentially recruitable too.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Marchetti has now a Jewish wife who's about to have his... So they're all a little compromised here. I want to just, on Marchetti, one thing that I thought was interesting is he has this conversation with Servier, right? So a big part of what Marchetti is doing through this whole thing is like, he's in love with Rita now, like legit for real. She's carrying his child. He wants to marry her. And so he's like panicked in this way about what has happened to her mother. He is responsible for that.
Let's be precise about that. What he has done to her mother.
That's
and
right.
He doesn't want her to find out. He doesn't actually give a shit about her mother. He gives a shit about whether she will find out when her mother comes back, because he's still living in the dream world in which people come back. He's worried that she will find out that he was dishonorable in that context.
Yeah, but this is my point that I think is actually pretty interesting about Marchetti in this conversation, where he's like, so where he's saying to Servier, she needs to send a letter to her mother. How does she do that? And Servier is looking at him like, you can't send a letter to people. Like, they're gone. And Marchetti is like, very confused. He doesn't, he's like, well, it's one thing to arrest them, he says. It's another thing, like, you can, why can't you get a letter to them? And it's like he doesn't realize these people were being sent to their deaths. And clearly he doesn't. I mean, it's a very genuine sort of like, I don't understand what's going on here. But it is a good reminder. We talked about this a couple episodes ago about like what information do people have and how does that inform their decisions? Because Servier seems to know what's going on and Marchetti does not.
Well, Servier seems to know that they're walled off from life. Whether he knows that they've been, you know, or that some of them or all of them are likely dead, I don't know. But he does seem to understand that they're in, that they're beyond the reach of the mail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I think that it is, I think that the quiet culpability, the question of what do they know, how much do they know, and how that informs their decisions, I think is an important evaluative tool as you go through this process of thinking through complicity and then later being able to render a judgment on that complicity. And it is always interesting to me when they give you a glimpse into clearly what people know and what they don't know. And I think it's interesting. You can be somebody like Marchetti who does these bad things to people in the service of the advancement of his own career if you don't think that what's happening to them is that they're being killed or otherwise, you know, something sort of terrible and they're now unreachable in this way. Where Servier does know it in a way that is not, you're right, not precise or quite explicit, but he understands a big degree more than Marchetti does.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was less moved by that than you were. When you're doing a roundup of these people, you're aware that nothing good is going to happen to them. I mean, Marchetti seems to think they're going to be sent to a labor camp. Well, you know, rounding up people on the basis of ethnicity to send them to labor camps is hardly, you know, a noble thing to do. And I'm not sure that Servier doesn't to this day in 1942, the November of 42, that is, think they were rounded up and sent to labor camps that you can't send mail to. So I'm not sure, like, I do agree with you that the show is intimating that Servier knows more than Marchetti does, but it seems to me they're both in the position of knowing precisely as little as they want to know and being mm-hmm. in denial about the people who they're serving are and what they intend to do.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the thing that I was reading into the show as a possibility of why they had this conversation and were trying to say to us that Marchetti knows less is that because he now has a wife and a woman that he loves who is Jewish, is there a change of heart coming for Marchetti that he is, you know, because we went through this before. I can't remember, but it was with the roundups that there was this period of time where the French backlash to it when there were actual roundups. And so there is this sort of breaking point for if you're not a total like sadist, whatever, there one assumes that people have different limitations and that like Marchetti is clearly a horrible person whose limitations are quite high on what he's willing to do to another person to advance his own interests. However, I think the show was potentially hinting at is like, is his current circumstance giving him a change? Like when you say it's 100% true that he does not care about the mother because he did that, I actually at this point in the show think now that he's really in love with this woman, and this would be like technically his mother-in-law, is he feeling a kind of crushing guilt about it? Is he feeling, you know, wait, what have I done? What's going on here?
Oh, I think he feels crushing guilt. And I think he felt crushing guilt in, you know, we saw that in the previous episodes where he helps the little girl with her cover story, Cohen's daughter. I just think his guilt is honestly morally meaningless. You know, he, like, you know, he does all these horrible things and then he feels guilty about it, to which my reaction is, you know, you feel guilty, so what? What good comes from that?
Yeah. I mean, sure, no good. It's not, these aren't like things that, you know, dig Marchetti out of his hole. They're just, yeah, like I said, I thought maybe the show was trying to set up a potential pivot. But we shall see. We shall see. Okay, we've gone way over time. We should wrap things up. But it was a great couple of episodes, and I think we're in for a good back half here of the season.
The commies are back, and yeah. The party's just getting started. So, Edith, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement. On me t'aime tous les amants.